I just wanted to say a very strong thank you to our excellent presenters, Winston, Adam, and Dennis. We really appreciate your insights on civil society engagement. And thank you also to our attendees who have been posting lots of questions and comments in the chat box. We will move into a Q&A session now for the next 20 minutes or so and ask some of the questions that have come through. And I also just wanted to highlight that the presentation slides are available in the resources box at the left of your screen if you would like to download those and review any portion of the presentation. And, of course, we are also recording this presentation, and we'll send you, as an attendee, the link to the recording in about a week's time or so, maybe a bit later, and that way you can share it with your networks or review anything that you missed. All right, so we had a lot of questions come through. We'll see how many we can get through. And I'll pose them either to Winston or Adam or both. Also, happy to have Susan jump in and Janice. So do feel free to jump in if you have any comments. I'll start off, I think, a question that came up a couple of times in the chat box and often comes up at our Ag Sector Councils, which is engaging youth and engaging women and how that fits into your presentations and into this discussion. So both Winston and Adam or Janice, if you wouldn't mind commenting on any specifics of how things are different when engaging the youth population or engaging women.
Hi, Julie, I could just jump in very quickly and give a perspective from Cambodia Harvest. So the question was specifically how we engage them and if there were any additional challenges. Is that correct?
Yes, if it poses any different challenges for civil society engagement.
For Cambodia Harvest, in commercial horticulture specifically, the commercial horticulture farmers that we're working with are approximately 45% women. And in Cambodia generally, you really can't be working in agriculture and not work with women. They're very engaged at multiple stages of the value chain, and it's really a matter of ensuring their participation upfront. So when we are introducing activities at the commune level, we make it very clear, and if we have introductory meetings, we encourage the participants as well as youth in the area. Sometimes organizing the timing of those meetings is a critical factor given all of the other tasks that women in a village, in an agrarian village, are burdened with. So we make sure we organize those meetings to raise awareness of what's taking place at times that are appropriate for women, and we do the same things for the knowledge transfer activities to make sure women are.
Great. Winston, do you have any comments on engaging youth or women?
Not really. Maybe I can comment on the engagement of women, and I can add on to what Adam has just said, especially women. In our program, for instance, talking from the experience that we have, that we give to the community is through the peer support, usually women and men. And one of the special features is sure that when women are engaged, there are several factors, including Adam, what has just said in terms of the timing, because like a lot of other women in the world, women in Tanzania, especially in the rural community, are usually the everything in terms of the family being the main breadwinner. So when you engage with women, you have to really to make sure the context in which this woman lived, and if they are meeting to discuss at what is time is appropriate for them without even compromising with other equally relevant roles within the family. Very specifically for our program, for instance, it is a nutrition program. So one of the things that are really being promoted is to reduce their workload, including the interactive time. So sometimes it's a contradiction because what we preach and what we are encouraging them.
All right, great. Thank you for those comments. Winston, I have a couple more questions that came in early on during your presentation that I thought I would pose to you. two questions. One is from Vicky Marone from Michigan State University, who asks, can you share the process of the...
Engaging women will...
Sorry, Winston,
especially
I...
Especially the married ones will...
Sorry, all, we had a bit of a audio blip there. All right, Winston, can you... You can hear me now. Please confirm. I think we just had a bit of a delay with Winston's... Perhaps I will jump to a couple of questions that came in during Adam's presentation while we wait for Winston's audio feed.
Hello, there was a question 2 seconds ago. I didn't hear that.
So I think I will jump over to Adam just to make sure that Winston's feed is coming through strongly. But Adam, we had a lot of clarifying questions come in about Cambodia Harvest, and so I thought I would just rattle a couple of them off. And one of them was, how did you measure the incremental sales when we know that we didn't start with all of the beneficiaries from the outset in order to have a good baseline?
Sorry, the question being, how do we measure incremental sales?
Yes.
We measure incremental sales compared to a baseline. So we do conduct a comprehensive baseline. Happens within 6 months of project startup, and then we conduct statistically significant samples of the beneficiaries of the clients that the project works with, and this can be extrapolated to the population level of the project.
Okay, great. And Vicky Marone asks, to serve the that you mentioned, about how many technical personnel are part of your work?
I actually don't know specifically how many field extension officers we have dedicated to the horticulture producer groups. We do have both agronomists on staff that visit groups and all beneficiaries once a week. And we also have local partners, local NGOs that have agronomists on staff. So we do this through both of those channels. And there in other cases, we also work through where incentives are aligned for embedded extension mechanisms. So we have several partnerships with input providers, as I mentioned, monthly field days. In those cases, they may deliver training on how their products work. For instance, a drip irrigation provider will deliver training on installing or maintaining the system over time. So if you contact me offline, I can get you the specific number of staff that we have dedicated to the horticulture side of things. I don't have that number in front of me.
Okay, great. And lastly for the moment, a question from Richard Tinsley. He was wondering if you could give an estimate of the advantage of bulking inputs and market produce. What are the overhead costs being incurred by the group to get the bulking advantage? Is there any quantitative information you can share?
I don't have specifically the reduction in unit cost data, and I don't know if we collect that for harvest. In terms of the overhead cost, there are no overhead costs for that particular function of the group to take place, other than transportation to the input provider, which are quite close. If you know Cambodia, most either at the village level or the commune level, there will be a rural input dealer. And we are also working to support input dealers, both in terms of training them on inventory as well as, you know, delivering that information to farmers that they need to. So in the areas where we're working, the input suppliers are very well stocked, and they began investing in stocking their inventory when they saw the increased demand from the project farmers course, the project farmers' demand increased when they saw the returns that they could generate from these improved practices.
Great, thank you. All right, we discovered that we had a bit of a delay just with Winston's audio, maybe about 10 seconds. So I'm going to go ahead and ask him a question and then pause to make sure he has plenty of time to answer. And so a question, Winston, that came in during your presentation from Gretchen Thompson, a scientist with Family Health International in Durham, North Carolina. Is long-term success in civil society engagement being measured? Also, are the social and behavior change communication, or SBCC initiatives, coupled with any other programmatic interventions such as economic strengthening?
Yes, I think I will give that to Janet and then I'll add on. If Nene also can answer from Washington, that would be great. But I think we start with Janet first.
Great. Janet, please feel free to chime in.
I was saying I would like to start with the second portion of the question where he's asking about if the SBCC is being coupled with the other interventions. Yes, and this nutrition program is hosted within the economic growth section, of which is mainly dealing with Feed the Future investments. And so it's about agriculture, there are value chains that we are dealing with, and so even the nutrition is part of that. So on top of the SBCC that we are doing right now, we have other interventions that are targeting on that diversification. All that has been value is working on, but also we have small components of and raising livestock just for the purpose of making sure that the target group that we are focusing on, women and children, are getting diversified food. Maybe I'll leave the other question, the second portion, to Winston to respond.
Yes, unless Nene, do you have anything to add on in the long-term measure for the sustainability of this issue?
I was saying that on this project, we have not started measuring long-term sustainability. We are like on the fourth year of the project, but it's a concern, long-term sustainability. For CSOs, I would say that it's critical for CSOs to be linked to government, you know, in terms of supervision, monitoring, and working together throughout the project, which we are doing already, to ensure that at the end of the project, when there is no more funding, that the government can step in and continue to work with these CSOs that we have built the capacity to implement.
All right, thank you both. So looking at a few of the other questions that came through, I thought this was an interesting one. How to discuss a little bit more the importance of the local context. You both stressed that. But a bit more of the how does one gain a comprehensive understanding of the local context in your project location. It's undoubtedly complex in many situations with limited time or monetary resources. Any comments on that?
Yeah, if I may comment on that, I think it is true. It speaks to itself in the sense that the different CSOs in different capacities, depending whether they're national-based or local-based, do react and grow and fluster differently depending on the context in which they're operating. And even in cases where, for instance, in our case, we refer to and we insist on making sure that the CSO work hand in hand with the government, which is usually a related institution to provide the services, providing also and helping or support the government to provide. In such cases also, the context within which that CSO do differ, in the meaning that Even if we say this CCAO is working, for instance, at region level, at district level, it will depend on the type of the administration at that region and that district. And one. But then second, it will depend on the nature of the community which it is serving, whether it is, for instance, a pastoralist-based or agriculture-based or pastoralist agriculture-based, or depending on, and whether it is urban or semi-urban or pure rural aspect, and the nature of the economic activity that is being engaged in. So there are lots of factors. You cannot really draw a line and say this is what will apply to where. Over to you.
Losing her.
Okay.
Yeah, I wanted to add that what works for us in general is recruiting local staff that are familiar with the culture and the context. It's really helpful, you know, 95-97%, I would say, of African staff is, you know, from Africa, which is very helpful in a rapid startup of project. They know the context. They don't need much orientation about, you know, what the community is, you know, how they think, what, why they do what they do. That's to us is extremely helpful in starting quickly and implementing, you know, based on what, you know, the staff know already about the people we are serving.
All right. We had a question come in from our event page online, so not here in this chat box, but from our event page that I think would be interesting to pose. And an attendee asks, in parts of West Africa, which are emerging from long democratic transitions, the private sector and professional associations have not emerged as a set of interest groups to inform policy and resource priorities by advancing the interest of their constituencies. Policy centers, media, academia are not meeting the needs for research analysis, awareness building, in part because there's not a big demand or market for such services from government or civil society interest groups or the general public. So how do implementing partners and donors support civil society to make this transition? Anyone can jump in on?
Julie, if the question is specific to West Africa, I wouldn't be appropriate to answer that. But just, you know, generally in Cambodia, I would refer back to some of those enabling environment characteristics that we talked about, and just a general comment on Cambodian civil society and their role in policy advocacy. It is an extremely contentious and challenging situation in Cambodia for civil society and local interest groups to influence the ruling party decisions where it conflicts with their own interests. And so in many ways, it really is about aligning the interests of communities with the private sector and the public sector development objectives. And that is a great deal of what we do in Cambodia through the technical working groups, which are multi-stakeholder platforms to discuss some of these issues. But in terms of political advocacy, that is not specifically something that the Cambodia Harvest Project engages in.
Now, if I may,
that's good insight, even though...
Yeah, if I may add in around that question in Tanzania, and specifically with the nature of the CSO that we deal with, actually the type of the civil society organization that we deal with can be termed as still very far in terms of journey towards doing exactly that, because the civil society that we engage and partner with are actually themselves engage in service provision. So in order for a CSO to really qualify to be a very strong watchdog or advocating for a policy, it has to be a civil society that does not engage itself in the service delivery to be able to stand aside and look and criticize what is going on. And that's not the case in our civil society, that the category that we are really engaged in in our program. And maybe Janet can add that.
Yeah, I wanted to emphasize one of the points Winston was trying to make in relation on the how the strength of the CSOs and you know the technical capacity of the CSOs, the one that leads to engage them in whatever I don't know field that they are capable of. And so prior, I was trying to explain on how it is difficult to engage a certain CSO in activity implementation at the same time trying to build the capacity. All we have seen is that sometimes there is a mismatch. You push them too hard to get results, but you get delay on the capacity building. So in that case, it becomes very, very difficult to just find CSOs that is really focused and can do the advocacy nicely as you would want to see, unless you just set aside sometimes to make sure that you go slowly building capacity and at the same time trying to engage those CSOs in activities.
All right. Thank you so much to all of our presenters for your comments. We're going to wrap up as we're at the end of our webinar time slot here. I'd really like to extend a huge thank you to our presenters and apologize for a few audio issues along the way that sometimes can happen when we are bringing in speakers from around the world, which is something we're always trying to do and trying to make sure that we bring perspectives from the field to our AgriLinks audience. But I think it was a rich discussion, and we know that there are a few questions that weren't able to be answered, but you're welcome to continue the conversation on the AgriLinks event page for this seminar, which has been posted a couple of times in the chat box. And we'll also share all of the remaining questions with the presenters. And I know there was also a lot of interest in Cambodia Harvest and the details of that program, so we'll try and get some specific information about Harvest up on AgriLinks, perhaps on the blog, to make sure you have the information you need. All right, so you can see that there are some poll questions on the screen right now. Please take a moment before you depart to answer these polls. They help us improve our events for the future, and we always like to know a little bit more about our audience and about whether this event was useful to you. We're always open to your feedback, and we really appreciate it. So thank you so much to Susan, to Winston, to Adam, Janice, and Nene, and all of the support staff who have helped make this webinar happen today. And we'll be sending you information soon about future events. So thank you very much for joining, and we'll talk to you next time.